Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight. Paul Cleary makes a welcome return to the Sydney Institute on the occasion of the publication of his book, The Men Who Came Out of the Ground, a gripping account of Australia's first commando campaign, Timor 1942. Now, Paul will be known to many of you here because of his position on The Australian. He's an economic writer for The Australian. He's been a journalist for 20 years. He spent 10 years in the press gallery in Canberra and is now a senior writer for The Australian. He was here last time around on the occasion of the publication of his book on East Timor called Shakedown. And partly out of the interest of that book, and he's also worked as an advisor to the East Timor government, he became interested in the current topic. So it's great to have Paul back. It's an important topic, and the topic for tonight's talk is Timor 1942, Australia's Special Commando Campaign. Paul Cleary, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Well, I was quite concerned when this book was coming out and some journalist friends of mine were saying, what are you doing releasing a book on the Second World War during an election campaign? No one will be interested and no one from the media will want to really know about it. So it's been terrific that it has had some coverage, and there's even a few journalists along here tonight, which is terrific. And it's great for the Sydney Institute to host this as well, as I say, just 4 days out from an election campaign. But as we are on the eve of the 21st, I thought that I should somehow, being a typical journalist, we always like to frame things, give it some context in the present day. And so I thought I should somehow give this a political context. And you might think that's actually drawing a long bow, but in fact, that's not necessarily the case. I want to talk about some events that happened on the 23rd of June, on the day that Kevin Rudd served his last day as Prime Minister. And that was when some much-overlooked events happened in Parliament House when he was hosting the visit of President José Ramos Horta, the President of East Timor. And at about 2 p.m. on that day, about precisely 2 p.m., I think, this photograph was taken, and I actually argue that it's Kevin Rudd's last meeting with an ordinary Australian citizen, because just after this photograph was taken, he walked back to his office and he found that the knives were out, the sharks were circling, and he was for the chop. And this woman in this photograph, it's a lovely photograph, I hope you'll agree, is Nora Keneally, who's become a very dear friend in the time that I've been researching this book. Nora is the widow of Paddy Keneally, who I say in this book is one of the most outstanding veterans of this campaign, and really made it his lifelong mission to remind Australians of the great debt that they owed the Timorese, and the fact that he and his mates would not have been alive, would not have returned from Timor, and would not have gone on to fought in World War II had it not been for the Timorese. Prior to the lunch, Mr. Rudd held a press conference with Ramos Horta, and he announced a total of 5 dedicated scholarships for the East Timorese students in recognition of the Timorese people who showed solidarity with Australia's Sparrow Force during the Second World War. And showed solidarity, I think, is very much a sort of a Rudd-speak type term for what my book is all about, and that is this amazing grassroots guerrilla campaign with hundreds of young Timorese boys and men and Portuguese as well, who helped Australia to stage this incredible behind enemy lines hit and run campaign that went throughout 1942. And most importantly, all succeeded in tying up several thousand Japanese troops at the time when the battle for New Guinea was underway. Rudd was actually responding to a grassroots campaign which has been led by a feisty Catholic nun and a retired army brigadier who have been calling for formal recognition and compensation for this assistance. But like a lot of what gets announced by prime ministers in visits and when they need a press release, it really was, I think, very much rushed and last minute. The scholarships weren't even given a name. Rudd didn't even make a speech during the lunch, which was I thought was quite odd. So while Rudd, on his last day as prime minister, became Australia's first PM to officially acknowledge Australia's wartime debt to the Timorese, I think it was very much a quick fix. And also for Rudd, I think he missed an opportunity to embrace what I think is really important part of Labor's World War II legacy. Wartime Prime Minister John Curtin saw the guerrilla campaign in Timor as a bold and courageous campaign by these guerrilla forces who would stem Japanese control in the region. And when HMAS Armidale was sunk, one of the things I reveal in this book is that Curtin had specifically wanted a reference to the fact that it was sunk with the loss of 100 lives in support of this commando operation. And unfortunately, the Navy PR men denied him his wish for some of this important defence security reason. The PM wasn't giving his way. But had Rudd known some of this history, he might have thought about a more substantial gesture. But then again, Mr. Rudd, unfortunately, has never really been a great fan of the Timorese. It's well documented, particularly by people like Mark Latham, that he was actively trying to undermine Labor's pivotal decision at the 1998 conference to support an act of self-determination in East Timor. And that decision by Labor actually triggered a chain reaction of events that led to John Howard writing a letter to President Habibie in Indonesia. And Habibie responded by saying, well, let's bring it on. And that's why the ballot came about. I actually asked Howard about this at a press conference in 1999 when he was sort of wavering and saying that Timor would be unviable. And I asked him if Australians really did owe the Timorese for what they'd done for our troops. And he gave a surprisingly candid answer. And he said that he'd met with some veterans who'd spoken of the unstinting support of the Timorese. And he said, quote, "I think Australians do owe a debt to the people of East Timor." Opposition leader Tony Abbott has also moved quickly to claim this legend in one of his first major speeches on foreign policy. He said that the Australia's push for a ballot and the subsequent intervention in 1999 was the repayment of an historic debt to those who had rescued and harboured Australians during World War II. And I should have put this slide on earlier, actually. This was Paddy Keneally, Nora's late husband, who, as I say, was a really amazing advocate for the Timorese, incredibly outspoken, and was always reminding people of what the Timorese had done. So Abbott's really tried to seize on this and to make the point that that the Timorese, that the coalition were in a sense repaying that debt. You could actually argue, however, the record really shows that had there been international security for that ballot, that the intervention wouldn't actually be needed at all, and 1,500 Timorese would not have died at the hands of the Indonesian militias. But anyway, I really think the point of my book is to explain in detail what this whole campaign was all about, why it's important, why people now are still agitating and still, why it's still a cause of concern in the community. And I'll just want to make a few simple facts to really put this in context. In late 1941, we deployed 23,000 men around the Asia Pacific to Rabaul, the Dutch East Indies, Java, Timor and Singapore. And tragically, all these poorly armed men were captured. Many of them were killed. We lost an entire division in the space of a few weeks. And all of them, except for one small unit in Portuguese Timor, known as the 2nd Australian Independent Company. This company became the only unit to face the Japanese and remain an integrated fighting force. Filmmaker Damien Paris said after spending 16 days with these forces that these men of Timor are unique in that they remained an organised fighting body all through the lightning Jap successes. These lads are riding an epic of guerrilla warfare. Months before the Australians met the Japanese on the Kokoda track, these bearded commandos were carrying out deadly ambushes on convoys of Japanese, and this is actually what they looked like. Very, very irregular looking operation. Growing long beards, looking very much a bit like Ned Kelly. This is Private Jack Maley, who features very prominently in my book. This is Lieutenant David Dexter, one of the most outstanding officers in the company. So these men had no razors because they were cut off from Australia for 2 months. They actually were without a radio. They had no razors, and they were fighting a very different type of warfare. A brigadier from Sparrow Force, from the main force in the west, of near Kupang, who made it through along with about 130 men. This is after he told his men to disband. Turned up and said to David Dexter, "Oh, your men are looking rather dishevelled, and why aren't they keeping their beards off?" And Dexter was hit back by saying, "Oh, well, so yes, sir, but they've still got their guns." And that was a reference to the fact that Dexter had known that the men in the west, under this brigadier, after he told them to every man for themselves, had basically thrown away their weapons. But in fact, the second company was still very much fighting. This all goes back to early 1941, when Australia decided to embark on creating these units of special forces. Initially, the British wanted to send these men into Nazi-occupied Europe, but when Japan came into the war, that all changed. These companies were later known as Commando Squadrons, and they were the forerunner of the modern-day SAS. The British actually went for men that they called very rugged types. Basically, they went for the rough-and-ready guys who come from the bush. They wanted men who'd be self-reliant, who'd be able to survive in unpredictable circumstances. The company was dominated by wheat farmers and station hands. In this group, they came from WA, mainly. Not all, a lot of the officers were actually from the eastern states, but they went for these farm boys. Surprisingly, a significant number of men who had grown up in orphanages, which I think go back to the fact that one of the key officers that formed this unit, his name is Freddie Spencer Chapman, spoke with a very plummy accent, very sort of toffee British, but hard as nails, an incredible explorer, mountaineer, had climbed to the highest peak of the Himalayas in the 1930s, had been to the North Pole. He was one of the early commandos in the UK who came out here to train these men. And he actually lost both of his parents at a very young age. So I tend to think that his thinking was, we need these people like him, basically people like me, people who've grown up the hard way, one way or another. There are a total of 12 such independent companies formed in the war, and later on we created units called Z Special Unit. But I'd argue that the second proved was actually the luckiest and probably the most successful of all of these companies. Unfortunately, the men of the first company, they were captured in Rabaul, and then they went down on the Montevideo. The men in the third company that was formed went to Ambon, and they were quickly captured. They were all bunched up in the main part of the island, and they were all captured. This unit, however, they were sent to Kupang, as I mentioned, and the main force remained there to guard the airfield as part of this what proved to be a disastrous strategy to protect all these islands, these lightly armed men who then faced this very heavily armed Japanese war machine. But on the 17th of December, it was decided after the British, Australian and Dutch governments had agreed that we would actually occupy Portuguese Timor, even though it actually was a neutral territory. We effectively invaded that territory. Japan only decided to invade because we were there. Previously, they'd actually avoided Portuguese territories like Macau when they captured Hong Kong, but they went there because we'd occupied it. We'd actually put some of their citizens in internment. So that really did draw the Japanese there. Fortunately, one of the other points I want to make, on the day they invaded, it was the 19th of February 1942. Does that date ring a bell to anyone? Darwin, same day that Darwin was bombed. And one of the things I reveal in this book is that the two events are very much linked. In fact, Darwin wasn't about Darwin. Darwin was about Timor. The Japanese bombed Darwin on the morning, 10 a.m, because they wanted to take out the Allied naval and air strength in Darwin, because they feared that it could be used to counterattack, because they were landing troops that evening in Portuguese Timor. And I actually credit my researcher, Haruki Yoshida, who actually managed to dig that out of the archives. This company was very lucky. In fact, some of the men wanted their unit to be known as the Lucky Company when they produced a detailed history of it a few years ago. And they were lucky because about nine out of 10 men came down with malaria. When they first landed, they were so badly equipped. They were wearing shorts, short sleeves, shirts, really no mozzie nets, really nothing to protect against malaria. So they went down like flies, and they decided, because of this great man, Roger Dunkley, who was a First World War veteran, and unlike most of the other men of the unit who were single, no children, they were chosen that way because it was a high-risk operation that they were being recruited for. He had a family, but he enlisted. And he advised the officers, he said, you've got to get these men out of Dili because it's basically just a swampy, mosquito-infested mess, and they're all going to come down. So they were all up in the mountains. So unlike everywhere else in Asia, where all men were all bunched up, Japanese just came and surrounded them and captured them, these guys were up in the mountains. And there's some pretty amazing night, though, on the night of 19th February, when Japanese landed, and there's 20 men on the airfield, and they're surrounded by hundreds of Japanese, and they just managed to shoot their way out alive, and all but 17 of them actually got out of there, took a lot of casualties as well. And this man, Joe Poynton, earned a Distinguished Conduct Medal for his bravery. He's actually believed to be, his middle name is William. His family says he's a direct descendant of William the Conqueror. So the individual acts of bravery were pretty significant, I think, in this campaign. But there are two other elements, I think, that proved decisive. And one was that the company had very good leadership. It actually had a few lousy officers, and they get mentioned in the book, but it had some really good ones as well. On the left is Bernard Callanan, who was the second in command. Jeff Laidlaw, they referred to him as the bull because he kind of like had a physique like the bull, like a bull. Jeff Laidlaw, as you can see, officers all growing beards, pretty rugged stuff. And Rolf Baldwin, who three of the senior officers who were very good. And I say in the book, it was really Callanan more than anyone else who went and rallied his men. He embarked on these incredible journeys over this front of 100 kilometres to basically think about how they could fight back and go on the offensive and remain an integrated fighting force, as Damien Paris said they did. There was every chance this unit could have just disintegrated because they actually had no radio communication back to Australia. They actually, their radios themselves within Timor weren't working. So it could have well disintegrated, but it was really, I think, Callanan who really saved the day. Even though I do say in the book he actually never led a successful ambush himself, he certainly got his men thinking about how they could successfully do it. And under his command, some of the early successful engagements took place, which really showed the men that they could fight back. The other key factor was, in the book I say, the Timorese. Oh, sorry, that slides here, because this is, as I said earlier, another really outstanding officer, David Dexter, who I have to say, during my writing this book, basically became like my research assistant, even though he died in 1992. And that's because he left in the War Memorial a massive collection of files that he produced. He wrote one of the volumes of the official history of the Second World War after the war. He was quite a bright guy, became a diplomat, wrote Volume 6, The Official History, had envisaged writing the epic book about Timor when he retired in 1978. And unfortunately, because of ill health, never got around to doing that, but he did leave this wonderful collection which had sort of instructions written on it for someone like me to come along and pick up his work. But the other really important factor are these people, the Timorese. And I say in the book that one of the critical factors early on was the really good behaviour of the Australian men as they roamed around these villages in small unit patrols of 3, 5, maybe 10 men. And the officers were concerned that early on there was some bad behaviour, as there always is. And they were really concerned that if they didn't present themselves well to the people and if they went around molesting the women, that the Timorese people wouldn't really support them. So they got some very strong orders early on, and from the consul, the Australian consul who was posted there, and he'd been there about a year and he understood the culture, and he said to the men, you've really got to be well behaved, don't go taking things, you know, like what the Japanese did, don't go knocking off people's property, people's livestock, and most importantly of all, really be respectful to the women. So there's Timorese people who've been treated pretty badly for centuries, and they'd Portuguese had always basically sent these colonial armies rampaging around the place, and all of a sudden these really well-behaved Australians come along and treat them with a lot of respect, and so the Timorese really, really took a shine to them. And that's why I say in this book that a really key factor was the support of the Timorese. I actually say what it gave them is like an invisible shield, because if you think about it, they're fighting a guerrilla war. But to be a guerrilla fighter, you're meant to actually be able to blend into the population and just look like anybody else. That's Chairman Mao's rule. You're meant to, a guerrilla must move among the people as a fish swims in the sea. But unfortunately, the Australians didn't look anything like the Timorese, so they couldn't actually blend in.
And Paul, our blacks went to the trouble of learning the language as well.
Yeah, so good point.
Okay.
I should mention that. But they did learn the language. They blended right in. In fact, Damien Herron makes that point. He said, these guys, he said, they've gone native, they speak native, they've just grown these beards and they just look like everybody else. But while this was great, having the Timorese support, this operation really had a life expectancy of weeks rather than months, because they didn't have radio contact to Australia. And this is where an incredible group of men came in, the signallers. This is three of them here. This is a recreated shot taken by Damien Pera. They actually built this radio set in a shed, that windowless shed that was actually used for storing rice. And a really key person in all this was this man, Max Lovelace. I must put in a plug for the ABC. He was the ABC's radio technician in Hobart before the war. These men worked day and night for 10 weeks. They were under enormous pressure. They knew if they didn't get this radio built that their unit was finished. And literally they built this radio out of bits and pieces, odds and ends. Took an incredible toll on Max Lovelace, who was sent back after they completed the task of it, and suffered from anxiety and neurosis, was discharged from the army, but obviously it was incredible. And the first signal back that they sent when they finally got radio contact on the 19th of April was force intact, still fighting, stop. Badly need boots, quinine, money, and Tommy gun ammunition. They put that in order of importance. The most important thing they need of all at this time was boots, because Timor has this craggy, rocky surface, same as the Kimberley region of northwest Australia they want to join together. And 10 weeks of patrolling had worn out their boots, and they knew that without boots that they would not be able to continue as a fighting force. And that's the radio, which this shot looks to be taken in someone else's backyard. I'm not sure where this shot's come from, but that's all the bits and pieces that they assembled together. When General Douglas MacArthur heard of this, he was astounded. Like, think of when this happened. This is April 1942. This is absolute... the darkest hour in our nation's history. We've lost 23,000 men. We've lost HMAS Sydney. And suddenly they get this signal through that there's a force of men still hitting the Japanese and actually having them running around in circles, this seasoned regiment, the 228th Regiment. So MacArthur, Blaney had actually wanted to bring them back to Australia, and MacArthur said, just leave them where they are. They're doing a really good job. So he left them there, and the brief was to continue their harassing role on the Japanese and just continue taking casualties as they did. But once they got radio contact back to Australia, the other really significant thing happened was this, that we actually then were able to radio back to Australia to tell them what the Japanese were doing, which is, you know, in any World War history, this was vitally important. This became part of the Coast Watchers operation. So this is an aerial shot from 1942. And as I say, the invisible shield that the men had enabled them... unfortunately, this shot is just a bit too narrow, so I'm going to have to use the modern technology and go to Google Earth and show you what was going on. Incredibly, look at this. This is the airfield that the Japanese built. The airfield's right there. Japanese built. The old one was actually here. That's the one the Australians defended. Get this right. The Australian embassy today is just about there. And the amazing action that took place on the 19th of February, it was actually about 200 metres away from it. So that's the 1942 airfield. Japanese realised this airfield the Australians defended with their lives was useless, which we actually knew at the time, but no one paid any attention to it. So they built a new airfield. And if I go here, so that's the airfield still there. You can see it. It's not used anymore. But our men were then operating this observation post just about 2 kilometres away, right on the bank of the river, in the cavity of a tree that had fallen over. And the planes, the Zeros, when they took off, actually used to fly right over them. And there were these villages here that were supporting, that were feeding the Australians and sheltering them the whole time, and they knew they were taking great risks. And the Japanese used to come through and they'd brush the tracks of the Australians so the Japanese wouldn't see their boot marks. And there's another observation post around here on the east side at a village called Da Lao. So these villagers were really taking great risks, and that's the view down from Da Lao, a recent photo I took. So you can look right onto Dili, see everything coming and going in the harbour, look onto the airfield. So this absolutely was vital. I actually argue in this book that the support that we got from the Timorese was really more important and more profound than the fuzzy wuzzy angels, who were in a sense really porters and stretcher bearers. The Timorese boys, who were known as criados, served side by side our men. They went into actions. There was also a brigade of Portuguese men, and many of them were ex-army or policemen, and they carried out some incredible actions, and they went into a lot of engagements with the Australians. And all of this really culminated in this force being able to take 1,500 enemy casualties, although many of them were West Timorese who were brought over later in the year. And most incredibly of all, and those statistics are a little bit rubbery because, you know, casualty figures on the other side are very hard to track down, and the Japanese aren't very forthcoming, or they weren't at the time, during the war. But on our side, numerous, just scores and scores of engagements, and we lost just 8 men in combat an entire year, from February till December, which really just, I think, is an incredible testament to the effectiveness of this force and just what an amazing guerrilla operation it was. Unfortunately, it all got very ugly, like all guerrilla wars do. The Japanese got sick of being run around, hit and run by the Australians, and they created militias, quite eerie the way it's similar to what happened 50 years later with the Indonesians creating militias. They also created an organisation called Phoenix, again, similar name to what the Americans had running 20 years later in South Vietnam, the Phoenix program. Same operation, knocking off village chiefs, terrorising the population, destroying the crops, trying to starve out the Australians. So it really did get very ugly. Our men, to some extent, did copy these tactics, and we started raising our own militias. We started knocking off people we believe were collaborating with the other side. Though I think what we did was probably a fraction. But the second was eventually withdrawn at the end of December, And talking about some of the engagements, one of the most amazing ones in this book is with Merv Wheatley, who's literally a classic bushman. He's a horsebreaker, a shearer, and his most recent occupation when he joined the army was as a kangaroo shooter. He used to shoot kangaroos for their skins. And it's a couple of the early engagements under Bernard Callanan that really set the die for successful guerrilla action. That early on in the war, these men were taking on the Japanese with larger numbers. Wheatley decided it was just three or four men you needed to, you know, quickly hit the enemy and get out of there. But the most significant fact, I think, of this campaign, as well as talking about the low number of casualties, is that we did inflict a significant toll on the Japanese, but we also forced the Japanese to heavily reinforce. So by the end of 1942, there are about 10,000 Japanese troops in Timor. One report I've seen that we continued bombing Timor throughout the war, and they believed we were going to try to recapture it, so they kept reinforcing. And so another report I've seen is in the order of 20,000 Japanese troops. But as I said, a horrendous toll on the Timorese people, and the census figures I've seen are taken before and after the war, and census figures are a bit unreliable in developing countries, particularly back then, but also anecdotally it indicates a pretty significant toll for the Timorese people. It's something in the order of 50,000 people. Also a huge toll in terms of the infrastructure of the country. This is a cathedral built 5 years before the war. This was it after we bombed it. One of the really satisfying things about doing this sort of research, I was talking to the bishop in Dili, Bishop Ricardo. He said, "Oh, yeah, the Japanese destroyed that cathedral. It was terrible." I said, no, it was actually us. It was actually the US Air Force. MacArthur, this was actually one of MacArthur's pet campaigns, and he deployed the US Air Force at the very end of the year because the war on the ground was getting harder to win because of the Japanese tactics. And so there was massive, massive bombing in this territory. This is Marpay. This is one of the key centres that it was an Australian base in the first half of the year. And this is the waterfront of Dili, taken after the war. All over the territory, a historical mission went around the country in 1946 just to record what happened. And all around the country, it's just bombed out buildings. So I've got a bit more to go, but I might actually leave some of what I've got to talk about to questions, because there's other issues people might want to talk about in terms of what I mentioned earlier about recognition, about whether we should leave it to five scholarships, and there's other things we could think about, but I might just leave it there and any questions.
Thank you, Paul. Thanks. So we'll come to questions and discussion. Before we do, I should say that Janet Grundy's got some copies of Paul Cleary, The Man Who Came Out of the Ground, which includes nearly all the photographs that Paul's been showing tonight. So we've got to no later than 7 o'clock. Can I just start off with your comment about the East Timorese supporting the Australians and then the emergence of the militias? The late Richard Hall used to argue that some of this account was mythology. He maintained, as I recall, that's from memory, that the Timorese were very divided, that some of the one you mentioned, supported Australia's, others supported the Japanese, others moved between supporting one group and supporting the other group. I mean, what's your research told you about the majority of the Timorese, or is the myth correct, that they all supported us?
No, look, it's a really good question. I think you're right that, in a sense, this story, this history has, to a large extent, been mythologised. There's been several accounts written. I'd argue that I'm actually the first journalist to actually approach it, which I just think make a difference, because journalists are all about accuracy, as you know. That's first and foremost. Early on, and for the first 5 months, that what allowed the Australians to operate, and as I say, you know, it is pretty incredible that we could do this, that we could have observation posts 2 kilometres out of Dili. I mean, that just shows, without the Timorese being wanting to betray us, again, on the other side as well. This observation post got pushed out in August, so from February to August it was running. There's a famous example of a Chinese woman who was really feeling really, really sorry for these poor men on this lonely observation post. And so she made some stewed chicken and rice, and she put it in those stackable china bowls and sent it down to them. So these men actually had Chinese takeaway on that that was ever heard of in Australia, which is pretty significant. But what happened in August of 1942, the Japanese got very tired of what the Australians were doing to them, and so they Timorized the war, and they created these militias, which were really quite, they were really quite savage. And that did cause the population to start to turn. And there's actually some quotes in there from a meeting that was held in the middle of this offensive. And one of the officers was saying, which I think is exaggerated, that they just couldn't trust any Timorese anymore. And the only ones they could trust were those who were actually with them, the criados as such. I think that was wrong. I think that the support was still pretty strong. But I think the Japanese did actually did succeed in turning that support. But having said that, I mean, for example, when they launched this all-out offensive, thousands of Japanese troops, thousands of militias, bombing the works, they only managed to kill 3 Australians. So there were no groups of Australians who were betrayed, and which would happen in the situation where, for example, in Dutch Timor, where the men only lasted 3 days of fighting, and then they were on the run for a few weeks, and many of the men who got away from the Japanese initially were then betrayed by the Japanese very early on. But that didn't happen. That didn't happen in Portuguese Timor. So I think the support overall was there, but I think it became more patchy towards the end of the year as the Japanese really did use those iron-fisted tactics. And eventually, that was why I think the Australians realised that they were losing it. And again, mention MacArthur, in January 1943, when they withdrew the reinforcement company, the 2nd 4th Company, MacArthur, you know, this was just his little sort of pet project. He said, no, we can't withdraw. Let's leave behind a small party. And that small party of men it was all over. Because, I mean, literally what the Japanese were doing, were anywhere the Australians went, they were knocking people off. I mean, the tactics were so brutal and so severe that people then were starting to... And then later in the war, in 43, 44 onwards, we dropped these Z special units in, and the same thing happened. The villagers really were just absolutely terrified, and they didn't want to know these people. They just said, leave us alone, because we know if you come to our village, we're going to get razed.
Yeah. Okay, so we've got plenty of time. Okay, now let's hang on. Yeah, we'll hang on. Just a minute. We're going to call that one there, then we're going to call you, then we're going to call that one there, and I'm still running the show.
Sorry.
A while at least, yeah.
Paul, just on that last point, Sister Susan Connolly from the Mary MacKillop Nuns, who did some research into one of the books written about this period, gave a talk at the Manly and Coosey Friendship gathering 6 months ago, where she said there was an absolute failure in Australian military intelligence the Z Force, Z Specials, in the sense that intelligence coming out of Melbourne to on the ground was inaccurate, and that led to the deaths of a lot of Timorese and Australians. Would your research support
That's in my book. That's in my book. I mean, look, that's all fairly well documented. It actually was well documented immediately after the war. There was a major report done on the Z Special debacle, and it really was an absolute debacle. I've got a chapter in my book called Armchair Warriors, and it's about these guys sitting in this little mansion in Melbourne, which was built, in 260 Domain Road, South Yarra, and running these operations in the Pacific and really having no idea. And actually seriously breaching security, like intelligence protocols, to the point where they actually radioed to men in the field that they had cracked the Japanese code, because these men actually were captured in the field. The Japanese were radioing back, pretending to be our men, but they didn't use what was called the authenticator, and that is the word that's meant to confirm that you are safe. They didn't use it. So they kept on sending these hints back saying, you've got to use this word, and the Japanese realised. And then the Japanese said, when they said, oh, you're safe, the Japanese, the message came back, oh, well, terrible, because we picked up this signal that you were captured. So, like, some really appalling stuff went on. But that's nothing to do with the Second Company. What I say in the book is that Second Sin and Come is a great example of men just relying on their own initiative, without the bureaucracy, without the heavy equipment and all the gadgets of warfare. The unit that came afterwards, 2nd 4th, was actually much more heavily weighed down with stuff. I mean, one of the things the British actually taught the 2nd Company, the 2nd 4th wasn't trained by the British, was to travel light. And 2nd 4th men were much more heavily, much more gear, a bit like the modern day SAS commandos. And then that then went on to the latter period as well with this dead special debacle.
Which was in what year?
43 to the end of the war.
And in the various theatres?
In Timor. It was at the debacle really happened of sending these units in based on false signals that were coming from the Japanese.
All right, well, I knew a commando, told me just after the war. I don't know what time he served in Timor, but he was there, and he said his life was saved by this Timorese. And when it was time for him to be taken away by the Australian Navy, he wanted this man to go with him. In fact, they all knew, and he knew this man would be killed if he didn't take him, but he wasn't allowed to take him. Quite bitter about that.
He didn't
know how many cases there were.
Oh, the question was about the fact that I was going to get to this in my speech, but I'm out of time. That at the end, when the men were taken off, they were forced to leave behind their comrades in arms, the criados, which the men, a lot of them, were very bitter about. There are indications that a lot of the men who were left behind were later killed. However, there was an ABC report a few months back which claimed that they were all actually sort of massacred en masse on the beach, which is not the case. But, it is a case that the Japanese did round a lot of them up, and a lot of them did feel quite bad. And it's interesting that after the war, immediately after, the men just actually wanted to forget the war. You know, they weren't like, you know, they had 3.5 years, and they just wanted to go home, get married, have kids, which they all did. Most of them all did. But in the 60s, they all started thinking, you know, those Timorese that helped us, those two have got to go back. So they all actually all started going back. And that's when they built this wonderful memorial in Dili. And they actually went all the way to Prime Minister John Gorton because they wanted to do something really big and really, you know, not about themselves. It wasn't a memorial to themselves, but to the Timorese people. And they got Gorton to make an exception because he thought, if I give you government funding for this, they raise money themselves. They raised about half of it, but they wanted to do something really substantial. And they did, and they built this wonderful wading pool up in the mountains, which was designed as a resting place for Timorese who were coming, you know, traders coming in and out of the village, out of the capital. But, a lot of the men did feel pretty bad. And then when they went back in the 60s and 70s, they actually couldn't find these men. I mean, life expectancy is actually pretty low. That's part of it. But I think a lot of them did perish in the conflict.
There's a question here. Yes.
Paul, Chris Hartley. My father was John Hartley, one of the original on Timor and later Z Special. So he spent the whole of 1942 on the island. And it is true that when the Australians were being evacuated, they wanted to take their criados with them, but they were not allowed. There were a number of older characters who were withdrawn for the purpose of Z Special. And now Dexter and Freddie Otway and my father all went into Z Special later on. My father did go back to Timor during 1945 and was shot off the beach again because Zed had been compromised. And again, I spoke with Fred Otway recently and he said, really, that the people in Melbourne, the armchair warriors, as you call them, should have been charged with criminal negligence because they did all the harm. Sparrow forces far on the Dutch side, all those weapons that they left behind, my father and others, Paddy Keneally, often reported that those things were turned upon the Australian forces. And when the men came off in December 42, they were walking skeletons.
They were.
My father is one of those fellows in that A-Troop picture there. They were walking skeletons. They could not have stayed any longer as it was. And it was only by the service, by the Navy, the small ships, Kuru and Vigilant, that sustained them. For that length of time.
Yeah.
But look,
you've got to be quick then.
Yeah.
Okay. Yep.
I like to congratulate you on the book that you've done. It is a very easy read and much better than the academic materials that has been produced over time.
Thanks.
And I'm very grateful to you that you also referred to the life of the men after the war. So I congratulate you on that. Thank you.
Yeah, I actually made the point in my book that probably their service think about it, these men were continuously, they actually really had no R&R for 10 months. They were on the go. If they weren't fighting, they were patrolling. And if they weren't patrolling, they were sort of like not really being able to sleep at night because, you know, they didn't know what was around the corner or who might creep up on them. So it's a pretty extraordinary service that these men gave, and particularly given that point you make, you know, 10 continuous months.
Okay, so...
And
I missed
a bit
of this, you may not have covered it, but what condition were they in mentally when they came home? And you said they didn't talk about the war. That's a familiar story of the Civil War. But have you got any stories of just how they wound from it all?
Yeah, there's a couple. Well, in terms of, I mean, obviously in those days there was no counselling like we have now. There was no sort of diagnosis. But I mentioned Max Lovelace being diagnosed with anxiety and neurosis and really because of the stress that he was under. There's examples of another officer who was literally found sort of running around. He was in a hospital after he got back and he was found running around in the bush in the nude and, you know, really completely out of his mind. I say as well there's some quite a number of men who suicided after the war, quite young in their prime years. So there is an indication that a lot of what these men did was, you know, really did have an impact. I've interviewed a couple of the men who were involved in, I guess, some of the really dirty stuff, raiding villages and you know, possibly killing civilians. It was hard to tell who was civilian and who wasn't. But there's a famous instance of Damien Pera, and he turns up just after they've raided this village and they've killed 46 Timorese. And I interviewed the last man who was actually in that raiding party. He's still alive, actually. And Pera then says, can you just sort of do it all over again? And they actually went and burnt another village and pretended to raid it. But this is with this propaganda. But anyway, the point being, I suppose, that these men were required to do some things that would have probably given them nightmares. And also there were some mistakes that were made. There were 15 men executed on the first day. Really, they were captured in Dili. They went into Dili. There was a routine every morning to go in. And because of the signal failure, they had no idea what had gone on the airfield overnight. And they went in and they were captured. And they were 14. One of them survived his execution lineup, Keith Hayes, and then was nursed by a Timorese woman back to health. But 14 of them were killed. So, the man who actually found running around naked in the bush, he was in charge of the signal. So I figure that he probably had a fairly heavy conscience.
But others came out all right, because we were talking earlier, I knew Bernard Callanan, who became an engineer in Melbourne, others, he was...
You got a photo of that woman in the book.
Yeah, I do. I don't have her here with me, unfortunately, but it's not a great photo. But yeah, she's in the book.
Was that taken a long time after? Was she that age?
No, it was taken in the 60s.
Yeah.
So she was not much old, much older. Yeah, she's probably in her 40s then. But Martins, Donna Bella Martins, who this man was shot, wound, bayoneted. She nursed him. But most amazing of all, the Timorese boys who actually put him on this pony and somehow got him up in the mountains when the place was just swarming with Japanese.
Did MacArthur supply those boots?
Well, no, we did, though. He supplied the bombs. He was true to his word. We supplied the boots eventually, although, as I say, I think this photograph, I can't be sure, but I think it's taken later in the year, and they've still got their beards. And actually, there's another one taken, this one. This is actually when they've just come off the boat from Timor, and this is at Larimer. And you can see that some of the men have got, it's a bit too bright, but he's got a towel over his shoulder. He's holding a towel. They've actually just had their first hot shower in a year. But some of the men, this is Jack Maley, an amazing man, really, really much loved, amazing beard, big guy, they've still got their beards, so which indicates the supplies didn't come through. A lot of the men I spoke to say that after they got supplies, a lot of those supplies just ended up in headquarters. So they actually were still living off the local population and still basically being completely independent.
Paul, go left, the second man on the top left.
That's your dad.
That's my father.
Yeah.
Half quarter Chinese. He often went, had to go native.
One of the things, actually, I've just mentioned about these men is you might think that this was a commando unit with all these big, strong, strapping types, which it was. This is Jack Murray. He's over 6 foot. This is Kevin Curran, first grade Hawthorn footballer. Big, strapping guy, really solid and fast. He won the 100 metres dash when they had a sports carnival. Kevin Curran, amazing man. He was on the airfield as well. But there were these little guys. There was David Dexter here. He's only about 5 foot six. So for those of us who might be sort of a bit vertically challenged, it's quite heartening to know that there were these little guys. One of the other, I mean, little guy like this guy, tiny little guys. One of the guys in the unit, one of the best men of all. And when you really think about it, if you're a guerrilla, you want men that are quick and nimble and not going to be make themselves easy targets. One of the most amazing men in this unit, who actually claimed to be a direct descendant of Ned Kelly. I kid you not. I don't think he is, but all his mates believed him. His photo's in his honour, but he's only about 5'2", just like he's like a jockey, and he's the sort of good guy. He lived on a farm, was shooting rabbits from the age of 8. So these are the sort of men that were in this unit.
So very briefly, the decision to deploy was made by the Curtin government, and the decision to withdraw was made by.
That's right.
Or was it made by MacArthur acting for the Curtin government?
No. The decision to deploy was taken by our war cabinet. That was all, and it was all part of it. It came out of these conferences. There were these conferences that were held in. Surprisingly, we really knew the Japanese were coming. I found that quite surprising doing this research, that we knew they were coming. But Pearl Harbor wasn't a surprise at all. So in late 1941, months before Pearl Harbor, we started deploying all these units to strengthen up bases in the Pacific and give these sort of forward air bases. And that was our decision. That was our decision, although General Sturdee, on February 15, 42, the day Singapore fell, went to the War Cabinet and said, "We have just embarked on the most disastrous strategy. We have run against every principle, every sensible principle of modern warfare, and that is not to spread out your forces too thinly, going back centuries." So they realised all too late what a disastrous strategy it was, and then they pulled them out as well at the end of the year.
So that decision was made by
Curtin,
by Curtin,
and the War Cabinet.
Wasn't imposed on the army. It was made in consultation with the army.
That's right.
Hang on a second, there's a question here. Yes.
Have you talked at all to the Japanese about the impact of these commandos, and are there any official histories from the Japanese perspective?
Yeah, well, I haven't interviewed Japanese directly myself. Took enough of my time getting through all the Australian and the Timorese side of the campaign, but there's a lot of Japanese records I got access to. I engaged a Japanese researcher who really uncovered a lot of interesting material. As I said, the point about Darwin being all about Timor, the numbers of troops actually were really quite staggering when you look at what they were doing in late 1942. And there are actually some of the best quotes in the book. I mean, the title of the book is from the Japanese. That's what the Japanese used to say. They used to say, these men, they're like, they come out of the ground. So there are quite a few records, and a few Japanese were interviewed for it in a documentary that was done about 20 years ago.
Congratulate you. I think you've done a brilliant job in bringing the whole story alive. And I think for many of us, the story is still very much alive. And many people do feel that there is still a debt of honour owed to the Timorese. And like the Keneally family, I have a connection with the Second Independent Company and have actually convened the Friends of Second Independent Company Group, if anyone would like to have information about that. We have links with some of the Criados, one very famous fellow pictured with Paddy Keneally back here. I had the honour of being at his 92nd birthday last October, and Gerald Keneally, who's here somewhere, was actually the last white person, I guess, or last Australian to be with him, and he died the next day. And here's a picture of a national living treasure, just recently deceased, who has not been recognised.
No, that's true.
So many submarines.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right.
Cool. Quickly on that. I mean, yeah, I think there is an issue of recognition. I have to make the point, though, I'm a journalist, not an activist, so I'm not coming at this as any sort of an agitator. I just want to write stuff and people can then make their own minds up. But I think there is an issue of recognition. He's the only man, Celestino Dos Anjos, awarded a medal for loyal service. 16 years after the event, they forgot about it. They forgot they wanted to give him this medal. But I think that there probably is an issue of recognition. I'm not sure the best way to go about it. One point I would make, though, and everyone talks about the Timorese, but I would actually suggest, just my role as a journalist, not as an activist, don't forget the Portuguese, because the Portuguese were absolutely critical. And I think if there is going to be any formal recognition or any... I think there is an issue of the fact that we bombed the place, and the place was wrecked and lost a significant number of its people, and never got any Marshall Plan aid after the war, and that's a fact. Again, after independence in 1999, when it was destroyed a second time, the cost of our military intervention was pretty significant at $2 billion, but then our aid program was $40 million. So we didn't really kind of give the country the sort of Marshall Plan it needed. But I would point out, I think there's some really amazing examples. In the book, I talk about people like João Vieira, who I think is one of the bravest people in this whole story. He's a Portuguese policeman. José Alexandrino, he's an administrator who basically was given arms by the Australian and ran his own army, eventually killed by the Japanese. So I think people tend to limit it to the Timorese, but I think... And also the role of the Portuguese officials. While Portugal was neutral, it was these administrators up in the mountains who were telling the local people, when we had no radio contact, we had no money, we got the Timorese to get hundreds of their ponies to move our ammunition out of the reach of the Japanese and up into safe hiding just after the landing. We had no money to do it. There's an amazing man in this book, Paddy Wilby, who really ran that operation. We filled out bits of paper on scraps of paper, IOUs, we'll pay you later. And the Timorese accepted it because the administrators had told them the Australians will be good for these scraps of paper. So I don't think it's just about Timorese, but I think there is possibly an issue to think about. Certainly I think it's definitely worth much more than 5 scholarships, which would have been awarded anyway.
Okay, so
we
take a final question.
I think you mentioned the importance of leadership in the Australian troops. You've hardly ever said before.
Yeah.
Good leader, good friend.
There were some really bad officers, and I'm slightly worried that...
You want to name them?
Oh, they're named in the book.
Yeah.
They're named in the book. Boyland. Boyland was... There's a couple of officers. There were these three key platoons, A, B and C. And A platoon, very excellent platoon, that was it back there. B platoon, also fantastic. But this third platoon had really lousy officers. They only had one good officer. And they there were no recommendations for bravery for any men from C platoon. This man was from C platoon, Merv Wheatley, who I say in the book, there's the prologue, first ambush ever, first time these men have seen action, and two trucks come along, these four mates on the road shoot up the first truck, and then they see a second one coming, so they take a few shots at that, and... he decides he's not going anywhere, and he's with his sniper rifle up above them, and he just continues shooting and shooting and shooting. And the Japanese just running around in circles, not knowing where they are. He got no bravery award at all. It's unbelievable. So it's pretty appalling when you see there was good leadership, but there was really lousy leadership as well.
Many thanks, Paul. Take a seat. Well, I'll be very brief. Jenna Grundy's got copies of Paul's book, and I'm sure Paul will be happy to sign them. Look, I think it's been a terrific night tonight. It's more than a story. It's sort of a bit of a tragedy, but it's told in a very compelling way, and certainly I've learned a lot tonight about not only what happened in East Timor, but also the Australia's Pacific campaign in the early days after this commencement of the Pacific War. So well done tonight. You've been here before, you're here tonight, and no doubt there'll be another project in the future. But for tonight, and in relation to the men who came out of the ground, well done, and I hope the book goes well. Thank you.
I have a present for you as well.
I got a present for you.
I just came back from Timor,
yes,
with 5 kilos of freshly roasted beans in my
coffee beans.
So I'm giving them to anyone who invites me along.
Well, that's going to be invite Paul Cleary to a talk. You get the coffee.
Get free coffee.
Yes.
Wary of Jose Rander's sort of warning about East Timor coffee. I won't mention it.
Okay. So there we go, folks. We'll adjourn for coffee. Thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.